welcome to another episode of Photo Geek Weekly. This is episode 30, recorded on June 14th, 2018. And it's funny because we've got a bit of a lull in the news in the last little while. Last week, I had Rick Salmon on, was a wonderful guest. We had lots of fun stuff to talk about that was newsworthy or otherwise. And I've got a similar guest on here today, a repeat co-pilot, Alan Shapiro. And Alan and I go way back. Alan has some interesting takes and biases in the photographic industry, but I've always pretty much agreed with his opinion on things. So it's fun to have him on the show. Alan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Don. Happy to be here.
So what goes on in your life these days? I mean, what keeps you busy, both professionally and otherwise?
Let's see. Well, I've sort of got a dual life going on. I am a marketing guy, as you know, a madman, with a heavy focus in the photo and video space, particularly with a large distributor of many, many brands called Mac Group.
And Mac Group, I mean, I'm somewhat affiliated with them. I mean, X-Rite's one of the brands that you guys steward there, and I'm an X-Rite Colorati.
Are you a color perfectionist?
I am. I mean, I've got some of their high-end gear. I've got an I1 Isis and a 44-inch large format printer. And I was just printing off. I'm preparing for a larger art show that I do every summer. I only do one art show because they're exhausting. And this is the one in my own city. But printed off a 40 by 30 canvas. And I'll be stretching that either later this evening or tomorrow. Just trying to get one piece of artwork done every day in the lead up to this so that you've got enough inventory for it. But if that print is, you know, a tenth of the way off that printer and I'm looking at it, it's like, you know what, that black level is just not what I remember it to be. Stop the presses or stop the printer. Just recalibrate it and just make sure that everything is to the nines, because it really is important and it's not that difficult to do so long as you've got the right hardware for it. Yeah. So, you know, I know, and I'm not going to bug you, you can't talk about a lot of stuff that comes and goes through your office, especially this time of the year.
With 21 brands, and many of those brands having multiple collections in a variety of categories.
And Photokina is coming up, is it not? So, I mean, there's no question that everybody in the industry wants to be innovative, that everybody wants to be disruptive and come up with something that, exceeds expectations, that pushes the competition, that, and that's beneficial, I think, to everybody. But for you, life must be pretty chaotic.
Yeah. But in the best possible way. I mean, you know, we're working to develop innovative products, disruptive products, which is its own challenge. It's like saying, here, go do a viral video, right? It's never as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny because I don't think I've ever had a video go viral. Some of my photos get picked up and some stories that I might write for the photo blogging places get, thrown from Petapixel to places like Bored Panda without permission, of course. And then that just kind of goes everywhere as viral stuff ends up. But, you talk about disruptive things. And in the last few years, we have had an insurgence of third-party lens manufacturers. We're talking Samyang, Young Nuo, even like Meyer Optic on the higher end, as third parties revitalizing old brands and old lens designs. And I bought in. I've got their Trioplan 100, which is a ridiculously expensive lens for an optical formula from like the 19-teens.
But it's pretty, Don. It's such a pretty lens.
And it's metal and it's heavy and, you know, it's just purely tactile and beautiful within that regard. And so there is something to be said for that. But the first story that we're talking about right now is a bit of a battle between one of these up-and-comers, Samyang, with an old-timer, Zeiss. And this is because the Samyang, there's a couple of lenses in their design, their higher-end lenses, the premium XP 50mm f1.2 and 85mm f1.2 lenses. Now, I'm going to put a picture of these in the show notes. In fact, I think I might make it the title image for this episode just so nobody misses it. The lens design between that and like just the overall kind of feeling of the curves and everything between that and the Zeiss Batis line of lenses is, I'm going to say, shockingly similar.
that's an understatement.
But, you know, it's interesting because they've got the same kind of bell-shaped, like an inverted bell-shaped design with their lens hood. There are differences between these two particular lenses. Number one, we should say what happened here first. Zeiss reached out to Samyang and basically said cease and desist because this is a violation of some such legal gobbledygook behind the scenes. I don't think it can be directly a patent because it's more of a design infringement than it is like an optical infringement. They're different focal lengths. They're different optical formulas. And a lot of the fundamentals are slightly different. But I think that there's enough the same here to make a call on. What's your opinion between these two lenses and if action should have been taken here, Alan?
I think absolutely Zeiss did the right thing and must defend not just their technological intellectual property, but their design intellectual property. Here's the thing. If you were to cover up all of the graphics, take the logos off, cover up the aperture markings that are on the Samyang but not on the Zeiss, and put it in front of a consumer, people would be confused.
Yeah, they absolutely would be confused. Now, you might argue that the fonts are different. You might argue that the way that the markings for focus on the lens are different. You could state that it's more of a seamless transition on the Batist lens hood, and it's more of a slight gap on the Samyang. You could argue that the Samyang right before the lens mount has a bit of an inverted arch where it's a straight diagonal line on the Zeiss Batist. And I'm sure the lawyers would go back and forth on all this stuff.
But there's no reason for that. That's laziness on Samyang's part. That is a blatant statement of, we like what they did enough to copy it.
Yep.
And
yep.
There are any number of design permutations, as evidenced by all of the other lens manufacturers, where this is outright copyright infringement.
Yeah. To me, it's the shape of the lens hood. That's what it really boils down to. If they just didn't have that curve that matched so perfectly, then this probably would have gone under the radar. And to say, you know, in the past, I mean, Zeiss was famously copied by Soviet lens manufacturers, like identical optical formulas and everything. And they just kind of gave the middle finger in the communist era, saying, hey, there's nothing you can do to stop us. Now, in today's global village, you know, where the marketplace is every country around the world, this sort of stuff ends up being enforced much more seriously.
And China cares more.
China surprisingly,
has, they have to in order to be a credible player who has historically had all sorts of baggage associated with intellectual property and copyright infringement. If you want to come out and be known for being fair and equitable, you better police your own companies.
Well, and China for sure. And there's a lot of lens manufacturers there now. You're absolutely right. Samyang is South Korean. And so they probably have an even greater reason to that exact same point. You think about car manufacturers. What if Kia completely ripped off a Ford design or a BMW design or something like that? You might argue, though, that cars, they do kind of feel like in an era of design, somewhat the same. You go to the mid-1980s, and yeah, everything was a box in the automobile industry. Different boxes. Everybody had their own take on it, but they do kind of follow within a certain theme.
There is a remarkable trend toward homophily, toward sameness, toward looking at the most minute points of difference and magnifying them so that we have a unique story. And that is just outright laziness. I'm sorry.
No, you're right. You're right. But you look back at the era of digital photography when it first started up, and they realized cameras didn't have to look like cameras. They could have weird rotations in the middle of the camera just to spin it because you don't have to worry about film anymore. That strive for uniqueness for the sake of uniqueness, that didn't last. People realized kind of the gimmickiness within that. But when it comes down to a lens, you don't see somebody making a square lens with round elements inside because it doesn't need to be square. It is, at the end of the day, almost always a black cylinder of some construct, or white. But I mean, for the most part, it's black. But even still, every brand has their own style. You know, you look at a Canon versus a Sigma, and there are stylistic signatures within that. This is the Zeiss signature on a South Korean lens. And so they pull down all of their lenses, and they're probably going to sort this out behind the scenes. But if you own one of these, I'm sure they're a high quality lens for what it is. You probably have a collector's item now, because they're not coming back looking like that.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you deal with this too, with a lot of the brands that you represent, that, you know, they're always trying to come up with a new and unique style. I mean, what do you have off the top of my head? You've got Enduro, and I've got their 5-way pan head, which is a really fun tripod head, which I used to use a lot for, you know, doing panoramas, even when I can mount the camera vertically, and I'd still have all the proper motions within that. And NovoFlex, which has, they've got like a quadrupod instead of a tripod, which is a pretty novel. And
I've got one sitting out of arm's reach, but.
Yeah, but their system is so modular where you can just really assemble it like Lego pieces. I don't think any other brand is specifically doing that. And so, you know, you see how all of that comes to play. And I think we're going to talk about tripods. You know what? Let's put the stories a little bit out of order, because I kind of segued into that. There was two new announcements, and I'm sure we'll see more of this with it being a photo key in a year. I'm just surprised that this is so early in that lineup. Manfrotto, who is a sponsor of mine, has added the B-Free Advanced Carbon GT and Live Carbon models to their travel tripod line. And I love their B-Free tripod. I've got one that's two or three generations old, the very first one, and it works really nicely for me. And Really Right Stuff has just come out with an entirely new tripod lineup with, you know, new features, better ergonomics, blah, blah, enhancement, make it better than the previous version. When we don't have to go through the minutia about what all of these particular enhancements are.
Come on, they finally added a weight hook. They finally, I mean, like, major ergonomic change.
Yeah, you know, weight hooks, they've been around for a couple of decades, and that's not exactly a difficult thing. I don't know, is it patent encumbered? There's got to be some reason why it wasn't there to begin with.
It's laziness. It's expenses. It's you know, to think about every time you, whether it's a CNC machined element, a shoulder, or a new head, every time you make a new tool for this, you're in the, you know, mid 5 to 6 figure range. So it becomes expensive, particularly if you're not selling. And as the category is growing and you have more competitors, you're not one of three major car companies anymore selling hundreds of thousands of a model. You're now selling tens of thousands of a given model. And then you have to have every single size within a certain product. It's too many pieces to make. It's too hard. And yet no one is doing anything truly innovative. I would love to sit down and, well, God, I can't tell you things. But there are, let's talk about Peak, and let's talk about how they've identified a certain set of problems within a, you know, an area, bags, and said, here's what we want to fix. And then they really did a very good job. Kudos to them. And we have Tenba, so, you know,
yeah.
And now
yeah.
Shimoda. So, you know, props to them. You know, no one in the tripod area is really doing that as well as they could. I think there's lots of room for improvement.
Yeah. It's funny because I was looking at some of the stuff, like they've reinvented their twist locks. And here's a quote from the DP Review article. It says, to show just how much thought went into what seems like such a small detail, Really Right Stuff explains how the, quote, inward-facing vents also ensure airflow is directed towards the center of the tripod and away from the mounted lens elements. No. I don't think anybody has ever asked for that. And is air rushing through your tripod leg ever going to be a concern to the front element of your lens? Man, the marketing people, I know you're a marketing person, but they took this and they ran too far past that extra mile, I think, with some of this language.
Claims need to be believable. They need to be relevant.
Yeah.
Who is who, to your point, is asking for a vented leg lock?
Yeah. I don't think it would ever show up on a photographer's want or need list for, hey, how do I make this product better? You know, right.
And now tell me truly what the benefit is. So, okay, so you may have stumbled upon something that has a significant benefit to me, but what is that? Tell me.
Yeah, no, and so it, to me, I like, I'm looking at all these tripods and they all have like a twisting lock mechanism. And I think that's the standard. It's probably easier to manufacture, or at least it's more robust in some ways. But most of my tripods, they have a clasping clamp mechanism on the tripod legs. And for
a
me,
flip lock rather than a twist lock.
Exactly, the flip lock. And if I'm in like minus 20 degree weather outside in the freezing cold, it's so easy for me to say, hey, that's locked in place perfectly without me trying to use my hands, which are completely numb at that point and have no proper tactile feedback on that tripod. And I let go of it, and one of the legs just slumps down and then the whole thing falls over, which has happened to me before. So I prefer the flip lock because it's visually easy to see, hey, it's completely locked in place. And it's easy to do that when you're in the field and you might have some thick gloves on. All these new tripods, and not just the Manfrotto, the new B-Freeze, my older one has the flip locks, the really right stuff. Most of the brands are going towards this twist lock. It's a more pleasing to look at locking system, but I don't like it as much. So everybody's got their own tastes and what works and what doesn't. But
and it loosens up, right? Over time, you will need to readjust your flip locks with a special tool. But you know, I'd rather
the special tool. It's an Allen key. It's not like anything that's terribly difficult. You know, you probably have one in your toolbox. You don't have to go out and buy a special tripod tightening tool to do this.
But do you have it on your keychain, or do you have it in your camera bag?
I do, actually, because I have a Really Right Stuff L bracket on my camera that has an Allen key that has a little magnetic slot right on there. It's the same size Allen key that the tripod uses. So win on design for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, but you're right. I happen to luck into that scenario. Not everybody's going to have an Allen key attached to their camera. But it's interesting to see how these companies saying, all right, you know, a tripod. I mean, they've been around for centuries. And I've got like an old surveyor's wooden tripod. From the mid 1800s or something. It's just a beautiful little antique. I'd never use it
to go with your metal barreled lens.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, most of the times you go into a trendy cafe and these tripods become the legs of a lamp. And so, yeah, I mean, they are a thing of beauty in some way. And you look at all of these new designs. One of the things that, and maybe I just didn't look far enough into the new Really Right Stuff tripods, but I'm not seeing a center column on any of them. My higher end Manfrotto tripod actually has a center column that comes up slides out of the socket and goes back down in horizontally, so that if I want to get really low to the ground, I mean, that's a fun design. They probably have it patented six ways to Sunday.
A lot of tripods will do that. So if you have a center column, you can reverse it. So whether it's a Benro, it's an Enduro, the interesting ones, and I know both Benro and Manfrotto have them, is the center column that will go up and then allow you to cantilever it in a horizontal form.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're a tabletop shooter, or if you're a food photographer and you want that flexibility, or you just can't make up your mind what sort of work you want to do, there are tripods that allow you to experiment with all sorts of things.
Yeah, and my earliest good tripod was one of the carbon fiber Gitzo tripods. I think I spent about $1,000 on it. And its design option was, you can remove the center column. You can just attach the camera together without it. And so I did that, promptly lost the center column, and it will never be reattached to that camera again. It's because it would take you like 10 or 15 minutes to reconfigure it to have the center column attached or not. So you're never, like once you decide to go out shooting with it one way or another, you're never going to change that. It's just too much of an encumbrance on the system. And so I guess, yes, there are ways to improve this tech. But it's unless people start inventing new materials to make the tripods out of, then I think that we're pretty much at the apex. If you spend like $1,000 on a good tripod today, there's no reason, I think, for you to go and buy another one for at least 10 years.
I don't know. I don't know. How many tripods do you have?
Five. but I use a lot of them as light stands. Like, I don't use them as tripods.
So I think I have 9. And some of them are purely for aesthetic purposes.
Oh, you're
I'm
one of those.
Like particularly colorful or not, or I just want a given look because I'm going to go out and I'm teaching someone and or a group, and I want to portray something. Others, like my NovaFlex, I mean, I go out and I have 4 different NovaFlex tripods. And God, they're amazing.
Well, I would like to take one of those in the field one of these days because I have heard such good things about them. But, you know, again, there are so many brands available right now, and they're all competing for my dollars as a photographer, as a content creator. And, you know, if I have what fits my needs, then I'm going to look to say, okay, well, I don't need to spend $500, $1,000, whatever it is, on a tripod that might be 10% better, when I can take that $1,000 and explore an entirely new area of my craft that I previously did not have access to. It's not revolutionary at this point. I'm really hoping that we have some disruptive stuff coming in this field. But we'll see. The industry, especially with rapid prototyping and the ability to cut costs in different ways, manufacturing has become in some ways cheaper. And maybe that's why Really Right Stuff put a center weight in their tripods now. But I digress. Let's go to a completely different angle on photography. And this one, I've got some interesting opinions on. This is from Petapixel, a story about a man that is now under police investigation for taking photographs of a child at a Starbucks. Okay, that is a controversial headline, to say the least. I mean, that guy sounds like a total creep, a child predator and all that. But all right, so I'm going to kind of sum this up here. A man in Pennsylvania was in a Starbucks for, from what we can tell, the better part of a week taking pictures. We're not sure exactly of who or what, but just like a street photographer hanging out on a street corner, my initial assumption would be of anything of interest, you know, whether it be a child or an elderly person or a bus going by or a dog sniffing another dog's butt. I mean, whatever that photographer thinks is interesting at that moment, he could have been doing. But a woman complained when she saw their child being photographed by a stranger inside the Starbucks. They informed her that the man had been shooting in the store all week and that they couldn't ask him to leave. So the woman decided to call the police, and I'm reading this from the Petapixel article, and write a Facebook post warning others about the quote-unquote creep taking photos in Starbucks. So, Alan, what do you feel about this? Is this an overreach by an overprotective mother? Should the police have gotten involved?
I think I might do the same thing, albeit with a little bit of a more measured response. I might approach the photographer and say, "What are you doing? That's my child, and I'd like to know how these images might be used."
Yep. Yeah, that's sensible. I mean, or as a photographer, ask the parents' permission if you're going to take pictures of a child. And it shouldn't be difficult when you see people walk into a Starbucks to establish who the parent of the child is.
You're right. But is it really just the child, or is it anybody? Because we all know that there is a style of street photography that requires stealth and sneakiness.
Well, exactly. Right? And I'm going to read a comment on this article from Bob Cooley, who sums it up really wonderfully. And so he says that he spent about a decade and a half as a journalist and spent countless days out looking for a quote enterprise photos, a feature, slice of life, etc. It's a very common part of a photojournalist's job. And this means taking a lot of photos of children playing, running around, etc. If a parent is around, I'd certainly let them know what I was doing after the fact, but not before I got the candid shot. And, you know, I've seen photos from one of my students of a you know, just a wonderful old center square in a European village. And there's some children there playing with those massive bubble wands and making those big bubbles playing. And, you know, you could just picture that in your head, how beautiful that would be. And from the sidelines, he's just snapping pictures of these children playing in the park. And I don't see anything wrong with that whatsoever. Even if you approach the parents, they might not even speak English at that point. You're just taking a photograph of this slice of life. Now, well,
there's a little bit of pantomime that's involved in street photography, right? I mean, I just came back from Portugal, so I know this well. All you have to do is you find someone and you point at your camera and smile mm-hmm. and nod, and they'll either go no or sure.
Yeah, or reach out their hand because they want some money.
So that there has to be some more context to the story that's not coming out. I mean,
true. But I hate when people just lambaste a photographer because they've labeled him a creep, a child predator, and you know that is not the case. Some of the most famous photographs, like of street photography, are of children. There was one linked to in the article of a child holding a toy hand grenade in New York in a park. And later on, the parents were informed that the picture was taken, blah, blah, blah. The child even forgot about it years later after the photo had become famous. Didn't even recall the exact moment when that was taken. And it was just a quick snap here and there. And so you think about this. Privacy hasn't changed in a long time. I mean, when you're in a Starbucks, it's not a private place. There's no expectation of privacy. And unless there is a sign posted specifically that says no photography or no shoots, no shoes, no shirt, no service sort of thing. I mean, unless something is specifically spelled out to that effect, anybody can walk in and enjoy that space as a customer. And I'm assuming this guy, bought a cup of coffee and sat around photographing the expressions of people having candid conversations. And then a child walks in. And yeah, should they have asked? Maybe. As a photojournalist, you might not. You might ask afterwards. The onus here, I think, is on the parent. Don't let society parent your child. I mean, don't be a helicopter parent either. I mean, don't be always hovering over them and making sure that everything in their right in their life is right and proper. But
back to the original question. So parent sees creep or person with camera. Let's eliminate any judgment photographing their child. Wouldn't your initial reaction as the parent be to go over and say, hi, what are you doing?
Yeah, no, that absolutely. Well, what are you doing? I saw that you took a picture of my child. Was she doing something interesting? Can I see the picture? And if it is just that innocuous, cute little look over the shoulder with a lollipop in their hand, just that wonderful picturesque, 3-year-old child's moment, then I'd say, yeah, absolutely. Can I have a copy of that? And if it's anything else, then yeah, I might call the police. But once I see it for myself, I can make that judgment and don't just assume that a photographer photographing a child is going to be a creep.
But would it be any different if I were sitting in Starbucks with my camera and you walked in and I just put the camera right in your face and I snapped a picture?
I know some street photographers, that's their style, right? Like they'll walk by you and just whip out the camera right in front of your face and they'll get the most absurd looks. I think at that point, Starbucks would have an issue and would kick the guy out. But if you're just minding your own business and taking candid shots from afar and just trying to capture the life of the moment, then, if that's innocent and it's been deemed innocent by the staff and you're a paying customer and you've been doing exactly that all week, then there's absolutely no reason for them to kick you out. And that's probably why they said, hey, he's been here all week. We're not going to send him away. So, it's always sad when these kinds of stories come up, when the public is just hammering down on a photographer for no reason. And, I don't want to really say it's photographers' rights. It's more of a moral thing here. But come on, people, we're all photographers. You're all taking pictures of other people's kids all the time, whether you intend to or not. I mean, if you have a child yourself, you've got pictures of their friends without their parents' permission. You've got pictures of other kids in the background at the park that are complete strangers because your kid was there too. And so you have to kind of draw a line somewhere and say, hey, you know what? Just gather all the facts. We don't have enough here. But the person that would have issues like this, they're not listening to this podcast anyhow. So Word to
photographers who think this is something they would like to experiment with and try, and or it's part of the repertoire. Here's the one takeaway. Try to do everything possible to minimize your level of creepiness.
True enough. Absolutely. So if I were to be in that Starbucks and I would be photographing people, what I would do personally, knowing that this would be a project of mine, and the Starbucks staff knew that this person was there doing that, and so they are fully aware, I would give them a handful of my business cards and say, hey, you know, I'm going to be here photographing, just doing this thing. I'll be a customer over the next week, constantly in and out, and I'm going to be taking candid photographs at the public place. And I know their policy has changed as some recent controversial events, which we don't need to get into on this podcast. But then if that parent walked up and said, yeah, here's his business card, go check him out, he's great. Like, oh, well, okay, situation diffused immediately. Yeah, then he's no longer a stranger. He is a professional photographer that is working on a particular project or whatever it happens to be. There's a sense of responsibility then. Yeah, cool. All right, I think we put that one to bed. Let's go on to something more fun and uplifting and pointless, maybe. I like to throw these fun stories in, especially when we talk about disruptive things in the photographic industry. There are so many Kickstarter or Indiegogo or crowdfunding campaigns in general that try to either revitalize old cameras or create new film cameras, revive old brands, whatever it happens to be. This one it's almost got legs, I think, because there is a bit of resurgence in this area. This is called the Instant Magni 35.
It's funded.
Yeah, by now. And it still has 31 days to go. I'm seeing numbers in Canadian dollars here of 66,000. I'm guessing that's around 50,000 US is what they were looking for. They've blown past that. And hopefully they get even more, because I would like to see this exist. I don't know if I'd own it myself. What it is it allows for the light from the back of many Canon, Nikon, Leica, Pentax, etc. cameras to be redirected down below the camera and enlarged onto a piece of instant film. I believe they're using the Fuji Instax film for this. And which, maybe this is a different conversation, but Alan, do you have any insight as to why Fuji is making huge successes in their Instax film and coming out with new products all the time for this?
Because they're really smart, intuitive people with a great technology pipeline.
And but it's pure analog and people are eating it up on a massive consumer level. I mean, we're talking about a Kickstarter campaign. That's an entirely different stuff than how Fuji manufactures and distributes things, right?
Right. Well, a lot of manufacturers are turning to Kickstarter and Indiegogo, the crowdfunded sites, not just as a disruptive way of introducing a new product, but as a marketing opportunity.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I've crowdfunded a book, and all of my initial pre-sales were through the crowdfunding campaign, and people wanted to see that project be a success, so they told their friends. And when it was down to the line, people were buying an extra book to give away to a family member. And so there was that kind of mentality, which I would have not had had I just funded the book myself and put it out on the shelf to sell. So
I can't wait for this to come out. I'm going to get myself one.
You are? Okay.
I am. Oh yeah. I mean, come on, we're living through this whole retro thing. I mean, don't you have a record player at home to go with your...
I don't have a record player, no, although I've got like a Nixie tube clock on my desk here. And so, yeah, you know, I call me a hipster if you wish, but it's a fun revitalization. I mean, I've got my grandfather's old Canon AE-1. Wouldn't it be fun the next time I see him to have this contraption bolted onto his old camera and take a quick snap and then hand him the instant photograph? Everybody would just be giggles about that. And would it be worth the prices? $100.
$130 US.
$100. Yeah. You supply the film and everything else. It doesn't work on all cameras. I mean, I've got a Leica 3 here that, you can't remove the back of that camera. It's not designed for that, but any camera.
Why would you want to?
In the what's that, Alan?
Why would you want to?
Yeah, exactly. Olympus, Canon, and I can see the AE-1 is specifically on this list. A lot of the Nikon cameras, the FM2 was quite famous as well, and the FM3. So I think that this is just barely good enough because, and only because, it stays in the analog world. It just instantifies it, especially with these wonderful old cameras that you know and love. There's been other campaigns that were finally successfully funded. The I'm Back digital camera back, which used a Raspberry Pi and a secondary camera. That camera imaged what amounted to a focusing screen where the film would be. And that's interesting. And immediately you get a digital file out of that. But anybody using an old film camera doesn't necessarily want that immediate digital feel, because otherwise just use a digital camera, right? If you're using the old analog stuff, you want that tangibility, I guess would be the right word.
Well, also, it's got a certain look.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
got a very distinct look. And I know quite a lot of people who are shooting Instax film and then scanning it in, digitizing it, because of that specific look.
Well, of course, I mean, there's photo filters and stuff that you can apply that would fairly, accurately approximate that, especially now that we've got all these fancy lookup tables and stuff to apply right in Lightroom or whatever raw processor you want. Well, you say it's not the same, but to a person of the digital world that no longer is holding on to the original instant photograph, it could be the exact. Well, I mean, that's why Instagram has filters, right? I mean, it's.
But you know what it is? I think there's, and let's get back to the tangible nature of this. There are people who are sharers digitally, online only, and then there are people who believe in the power of something that they can hold in their hands. So people like you and I who believe in fine art printing, who have respect for the craft of printing. Not just because it is something tangible and it has a very distinct look and feel, especially when you gift it to someone, but because it does make your overarching craft better. The way you look at a final print affects the way you would process.
Oh, exactly.
Right? So I think that this whole retro thing, give me something I can hold in my hand and I can hand to someone else in this digital age of instant on and instant gone forever, this becomes slightly more permanent. Even though it is very lo-fi.
It is very lo-fi. Now, if you were to get like an actual Fuji Instax camera, it understands exactly what the settings should be to expose its film properly. And so I'm assuming that as a photographer, you've got to dial in the right settings because, again, it's a sort of a static ISO type of scenario here, and you've got to understand exactly how to expose for that. I'm not sure exactly how much latitude that has compared to a negative to get it right or wrong. But I could easily see myself taking, how much does a Canon, like an old A1 even, you know, go back even farther to have something even beefier and clunkier? I think I might buy one too. Now for $100, I just, even for using it a handful of times, it might just be worth that experience. Yeah.
And it's not that ugly and clunky and whatever. In fact, it's kind of a novelty item. I think at a party, it's a great thing.
It does kind of look like a pedestal that the camera is just sitting on. If you were to put the camera on the desk, it's got the Instax size box in the bottom and then a little cone shaped thing that does look like a pedestal.
Elevate the old camera to this iconic status, right? It's now a heroic object on a pedestal.
And I'm so glad that we live in an era where people can come up with an idea, rapidly prototype this through 3D printing, get some cheap optics to make this happen that are from lots of catalogs like Edmund Optics whatever you want. Put this together, prototype it quickly, get the funding, mass produce this, make enough money for themselves to keep themselves in business, and all the photographers benefit. So cool. We live in very interesting, and I might even say disruptive times for stuff like this. This is not going to take any money away from the new camera purchases and new lenses or anything like that. There's no competition there. It's just more money in the photographic space, and makes me happy. So
it's another object that photo collectors are going to want to have.
Yeah.
Just because they can.
Yep. All right. For a slow news week, I think we kind of rounded out a pretty fun discussion there, which brings me into the picks of the week section. And Alan, I'm going to ask you to go first. You gave me a quick hint as to what it was that you were going to be picking, and you have me ever so curious.
Yeah, so I, you know, like you, I love macro photography, and there are times where I love a light box. One, because I can, you know, I can backlight certain objects, or I can just provide a level of ambient light, or I can augment the ambient light. And my friends at Kaiser have created this super thin, it's 3 millimeters thin.
Oh, wow.
Per battery rechargeable, so I can plug it into a wall, but then I can literally take it with me in my camera bag, and it is a perfectly 5600K light box. Super thin, ultra lightweight, infinitely portable. And it comes in 3 sizes, and I love it to death. And it is so much fun to play with. You might like this, Don. I literally turn it upside down, and I blow bubbles underneath it. So I've got top lit bubbles in a black environment, and it's like being a kid. It's like being a 5-year-old playing with bubbles, but now I get to, you know, take pictures of them.
Yeah, well, and I could imagine, like, if you want to do product photography, amazing solution here, especially if you're looking for, like, a solid white background, good subject isolation. You know, I've got a lot of projects that involve, like, time-lapse photography, some that I haven't had a chance to get to just yet. And something like this would be ideal because your lighting is constant, consistent, very, very even. Especially if you can plug it in for time-lapse work and it'll just run off of the wall power, that's great. I've got some wild orchids that are just about to bloom in my backyard. And I've been thinking actually of trying to do time-lapse of them blooming. And what I could do is just drape some black felt over the entire area and put one of these light boxes just on top and let it sit there. For the day when it's going to be coming out and fully coming to bloom. So yeah, lots of different purposes for something like that. And they make them big too. I think you had 2 different sizes.
Yeah, I've got one that is, let's see, I think it's A4 plus, so it's probably 13 by 19.
Yep.
And then there's a medium size. So it goes from, like, you know, 9 by 12 all the way up. And they're so easy to maneuver, and different from time lapse, I'm literally putting a flower on it, and I'm letting it die. I'm letting it deteriorate.
Oh, cool! So, and play that backwards. You know, it's kind of coming back to life. That would be kind of interesting. How much do these cost?
Let's see. They're in the $100 to maybe $250 range.
Well, I mean, that's what you would pay for a flash or any other decent light source. I mean, I've recommended flashlights to people that cost $100 to $150, and so it's
and the lighting, you know, for a light box. I mean, you know, they were originally intended for people to do, you know, to check their negatives for, you know, the more traditionalists of the world. But it's more fun in this day and age to just play with it as a creative tool.
Oh, absolutely. Do you know what their CRI is, the color rendering index? Well, that's the temperature, but that's the aggregate temperature. So the color rendering index, I'm assuming it's probably going to be pretty good. Most LEDs now are in the 90s.
This is 95.
There you go. That's pretty good. That's right up there. Awesome. That's a great pick. You know, speaking about things that make your life easier, I had a colleague he was in the printing business and decided to get out of that and kind of change his life, and more power to him. He's doing great, but he got rid of his printer and a lot of his paper. He was holding on to some rolls of paper until the very last minute when he had to move, and he called me up and said, "Don, just come get all this stuff." And in there was a bunch of different luster and metallic paper, but there was one roll he was so reluctant to give me. And this was a roll of Ilford Gallery Prestige Gold Fiber Silk. And a beautiful 24-inch roll of this paper. And I hadn't bought it before. I mean, it was expensive, and I'd seen it on the market, but I had other favorites and everything. It instantly became a favorite of mine when I went to go and print it as a substitute for something else that I had ran out of. And the customer I was printing something for just loved it as well. This paper... It's smooth, kind of like a glossy print, but it doesn't have that glossy reflectiveness to it. It maintains color really, really well. It's got a beautiful bright white point. And when I ran it through my color calibrator, it was giving me a color gamut far greater than anything else, any other kind of paper that I have. And I've used a lot of Ilford papers before. They've got a matte paper that's since been discontinued that I use to print stereo cards in because it's completely flat, non-reflective at all. So they've always been on my radar. And if you do any of your own printing, pick up even just like a sample pack of this and test it yourself. The gold fiber silk from Ilford, and it's worth every penny. It's expensive, sure. But if your print
is no more expensive than any of the other major players in the fine art category.
That's true. And, you know, Ilford's been in the paper business for an incredibly long time. And this has been on the market for quite a while, too. And I know it's a favorite of a lot of people. But, you know, if you're going to be selling your artwork, as I do, as I mentioned, you know, at various art shows and what have you, I just went to one of the local craft stores, had a sale on smaller frames. And for those, I buy them ready-built instead of getting them custom-made. Every picture going in those frames is going to be printed on gold fiber silk. Just because I've got the paper here, I've got that roll, and when it goes, I'm going to have to buy myself a 44-inch roll of that stuff. So anybody out there that's printing, get this. You should have this in your repertoire of paper to choose from. And if you don't print, then I've mentioned this before, there's no greater time to get into that because I think I saw, I don't know if the deal is still on, but periodically Canon will have one of their photo printers on for like $50. That's regular $300 through various rebate programs and what have you, because once you buy into it, I mean, they'll make their money back with ink and everything else that they'll sell you. For the cost of, you know, going out to the movies or, you know, the cost of an expensive lunch or whatever, you could buy a photo printer. You don't have to spend a whole lot of money. One of my picks previously was the Canon Image ProGraph, the Pro 2000, which is unbelievably inexpensive. A 24-inch printer costs you like, what, $1,600. This thing weighs more than I do. I can't imagine them making any money on it. But anyhow, I digress. My pick is the gold fiber silk paper. And anybody who's anybody in the printing world should check it out if you haven't already. Okay, Alan.
Can we add gold mono silk on top of that for those people who really like black and white?
Oh, paper? Yeah. You know, I haven't tried that paper yet because I don't do a whole lot of black and white, to be honest. But their mono silk is designed around a white point that very, very favors a black and white print and holds those colors together very nicely. Now, I should say for black and white printing, you'll want to have a printer that does have the various gray inks and what have you to give you a proper monochromatic print that doesn't have any color cast. Even a properly calibrated printer, if you're only dealing with three inks or something, might have a slight green or a slight purple hue to it, especially as the print ages. But a good printer and a good paper make a winning combination.
And a good color calibration, a good color management system.
Of course.
Will allow you to now profile for black and white printing, not just color printing. The new i1 Studio from X-Rite.
Yeah, well, and I've got the i1 the Color Monkey from X-Rite, and it's kind of the same thing. It's the older version of it, you know, that'll do monitors and printers and everything else. And one of the beautiful things that when I first bought that, and this was before I was a Colorati sponsored by X-Rite, I paid full price for this. It'll allow you to do a general calibration for all possible scenarios. But then when you have a specific print that you want to make, you can print out a chart just for the colors within that print. And so I had a few iconic images that I was going to print, my maple leaf flag photograph, which has red maple leaves on a bed of snow. I created a version of that image that was just the red leaves on one side, and it made a test chart of just all of the various shades of red in that print. And then I added that to the profile to make sure that the colors came out perfectly. It's not a hard thing to do. Yeah. All right. Enough trying to sell stuff. I mean, that's what we do. I mean, my background is in advertising and marketing. I know that's what your day job is, Alan. And I know you're smiling because there are so many things you want to tell me right now on the air that you can't even whisper. Oh, well, but I do want to ask, as we kind of wind down this this episode, what's coming up for you? I mean, do you have any photography projects that you might be working on? Do you have any?
I'm always working on new stuff. I've gotten, you know, my macro stuff. I've got a big macro conference out of Chicago coming up in mm-hmm. August, where I'll be out there for the week with a whole bunch of other wonderful folks. I am in the process of switching camera systems.
Ooh, okay. So let's add this on to the end of this conversation. From what to what?
I am going from Canon, and I've been a Canon aficionado since I first was handed a camera, which was only about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I have not been a photographer my whole life. And I am fully on board with Fuji. I have the X-T2, I have a GFX 50S on the medium format side, and I just got to tell you, it's some people say gear doesn't make a difference. Sometimes gear makes a difference.
Well, last year I asked Panasonic to loan me the GH5 to take on vacation with me. My wife and I go to Bulgaria every summer. And that was liberating compared to carrying my 1DX Mark II and an assortment of big, heavy lenses. To carry a much smaller camera like that was... I mean, it was innovative. It was very, very powerful. And the lenses and the weight was, I mean, it almost felt like I wasn't carrying the camera, where my shoulders were aching after a week carrying that around. So I've been actually working with Panasonic in the last little while, shooting quite consistently with the GX9, one of their new, you know, smaller, more travel-oriented cameras, and coming up with work that rivals what I can do with my Canon big guns. Partly because I've had people approach me and say, you know what, Don, I'm not going to have camera gear like yours. I can't get up to that level of professionalism. It's because people are associating the gear with the ability of the photographer, which has always been the case. You know, it's a misconception, of course. But now that I'm shooting with this tiny little GX9 and coming out with some, you know, pretty groundbreaking images, if I do say so myself, when I come up with a concept and I execute it, and I think to myself in the back of my head, I don't think anybody's done this before. That makes me happy. And I'm doing it all with the Micro Four Thirds system right now. Just like you with the Fuji, it feels like, you know, this box that you've been living in has just been torn to shreds, and there's an entirely new world to explore beyond it.
Right. And my shoulders and my wrist and my back is saying a huge thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, now, it's amazing the kind of glass from both the first party manufacturers and those third party lens manufacturers, like we were mentioning at the beginning of this episode, coming in and saying, "Yeah, we'll make anything for any mount." You know, so you can get, I don't even know the Rokinon and Samyang and Young Nuo and whomever else. I mean, there's tons of them for every camera mount under the sun. And some of those old vintage lenses that you can get for $20 on eBay can be easily adapted to any of these cameras. Who was it? It was Doug Kay had recommended as his pick of the week in a much earlier episode of Photo Geek Weekly, the Mir 1B camera lens, which a Soviet era lens. I bought mine for about $30 with shipping out of the Ukraine. The front element of the lens can be unscrewed and put in backwards. And in doing so, it creates a lens baby-like effect where all of the bokeh around the edges of the frame really pushes out like a firework kind of effect. And it's kind of a one-trick pony, I'll admit, but for $35, and I can put that on any camera that I want, you know, because you just buy the mount adapter. You know, we live in a golden age of photography. Yeah. All right. Now, I should mention what I'm working on right now is a series of images. I posted a few of them where I'm using natural elements, but both organic and inorganic. So crystals and minerals and things like that interacting with the natural world in some way. So the one I did most recently was a fluorescing, yellow fluorescing crystal amidst some thyme or moss or with small little plant life, and I put flowers growing towards it like it's the sun when it's fluorescing, and it turned. I had the concept for 2 years, and I finally was able to execute it. Right now, I am trying to have grapevine tendrils in my yard wrap themselves around another fluorescent crystal so that they can hold it up suspended in a water vortex. And so, you know, they've got these little twirly things that can make a little tornado appear inside of water. Well, I bought one of those kits to have that done with a little motor and a 2-liter pop bottle. And so I'm going to have this crystal dangling into this water vortex, but not touching the water so that they both kind of are framing. And I might find like a weevil or a praying mantis nymph or something to have kind of resting somewhere within this structure. I have no idea how it's going to work. Right now I'm trying to get the grape tendrils to wrap around things. But it's crazy how these ideas come up. I think to myself, yeah, nobody's ever done this before, clearly. And my accountants are going to come to me and say, Don, really? A kid science experiment, and a 2-liter Coke bottle. How are these business expenses for you? Well, look at the photograph that I've come up with, as a result from that. So, experimentation I think is key for me, and I gotta always keep myself thinking about these ideas. And sometimes they take weeks or months to plan, but I don't mind. Yeah, fun stuff. Okay. I've taken enough of your time, Alan. We're almost at the hour mark, which is where we typically try to end off. Where can people find you, though? I mean, your musings about Fuji and all of your new series of work.
Let's see. So alanshapirophotography.com is my website. Yep. They can find me on Facebook or Instagram. Just, you know, put my name in.
Alan, 1L.
1L, ALANSHAPIRO, photography. Don't spell it wrong, folks. And or you can find me at any of the botanical gardens in the, 500-mile radius of New York City.
Well, I might find myself down in the New Jersey area for a botanical garden tromp in, in September. So maybe I'll jump over to New York on my way home.
Excellent.
All right.
I will entertain you and get you drunk.
Sure. I can be found at donkom.ca, donkom.ca. That's where you find all of my social media connections as well. So if the concept that I just described to you sounds interesting, maybe in a week you will see a photograph, either success or failure of that attempt. I'll share either way. And for the show notes, all the stuff that we talked about on this podcast, you can find that at photogeekweekly.com. Thank you guys so much for listening. And keep in mind, if you do go to photogeekweekly.com, we do have a Patreon support button there. You can check that out. Help us produce every episode, because this is still being produced at a loss. I mean, it's a labor of love, but it would be great if I could make at least a few dollars off of this, put more time and effort into new shows in this network. And you guys can make that happen. There's a tip jar there as well if you want to just help out. And thank you for everybody that has done that lately. It really does make a big difference. On that note, thanks so much. Everybody should get out and shoot.